I'd just like to introduce, if I could, our speaker for this concurrent session, Lisa Simpson. I'm sure a few of you know Lisa. Lisa's a partner at PwC, and she's an actuary who specialises in advising injury schemes. She currently holds a number of scheme actuary roles, and she's a regular presenter at injury scheme seminar and other conferences. And Lisa's going to be speaking to us this afternoon about interactions between income systems. So just join me in thanking Lisa, please.
Thanks, David. Oh, actually, how's that? Good. So the genesis of this paper, I haven't written a paper, it's not up on the website yet, but it will be soon, was really some work that my colleague Raywin Davies started back in 2011, where she was looking at the impact of scheme design and its interaction with welfare in terms of people's overall replacement of their income when they were injured. So I thought I'd try and expand that piece of work, particularly in light of some trends we've observed in insurance in superannuation, particularly TPD benefits. We've seen quite a marked increase in TPD through superannuation. So I started questioning, well, why is that? Is that because we've made changes to injury schemes and so people therefore are seeking to get benefits from other sources? Or is it because we've got demographic shifts underway? We've got ageing populations and so on. Or is it to do with the GFC? You know, are there any trends that I can pull apart and try and understand and try and get a picture as to how all the income systems interact? I'll cut to the chase for those of you who, you know, want the definitive answer about how all these things work. I don't have the definitive answer, but certainly we can find some hypotheses by looking at all the different trends, and that's what I'm going to take you through today. So if anyone wants the definitive answer, you probably can leave and just read the paper at your own leisure later. So let's start by defining what do we mean by income systems. And this is the same definition that Raywin used back in 2011, but adding in superannuation. So three sources of income are individual savings, and here particularly TPD benefits through super is the component I'll focus on, government benefits, welfare in particular, and the compulsory insurance, namely injury schemes, workers' compensation and CTP. So what I was trying to do was to check what is the experience across the different income streams, and I'll go through some trends there, and what interactions can I pull apart between income schemes, and how do scheme benefit changes, behavioural economics and demographic shifts play their part. And ultimately, I guess the use of this paper is to help people who are working in injury schemes try and put themselves in their injured client's shoes and figure out from their perspective what drives or motivates them to choose different pathways in terms of their income systems available to them. So let's start with the trends I mentioned, in particularly TPD claiming through superannuation. And I've got some APRA data here. So the top graph shows the total insurance proceeds being paid out by APRA-regulated super funds. And you can see the really marked growth there over time, particularly post the GFC, about 2008-2009, the payouts ramp up, and they've continued. So that's a topic that's well discussed within actuarial seminars, this particular trend. And breaking it down, the bottom graph actually shows it for the top 10 largest super funds. And you can see the trend is pretty similar, but it starts at different points in time for different funds. And look, one of the questions I had was whether there's any relationship there between those particular funds and the members, the states where their members live, and is there any interaction there between what's happening in injury schemes in those states and the trends within the super funds. But to be honest with you, that's not possible to determine from the data. I thought that would be a good avenue to go down, but really couldn't find that. But anecdotally, you know, talking to people who work in QSuper, there has been some evidence of, you know, of increasing trends there. But, you know, given it's happening pretty much across all of these large 10 funds, I think you can't be definitive as to, you know, any particular state, any change in benefits. But maybe some of the Queensland benefit changes in the workers' scheme there have had an impact on the TPD utilisation in Queensland. It's a hypothesis. So what else could be at play? So I think, generally speaking, you know, people aren't very knowledgeable about their superannuation. Most of them wouldn't have even known that they have TPD insurance available as a default option in many super funds. So I guess one of the things that has been driving that behaviour would have to be the advertising of plaintiff solicitors. And up there, I've just reproduced one of the ads from Maurice Blackburn, who are particularly focusing now. They've got divisions of solicitors who particularly focus on TPD claims through superannuation, and they advertise there just to let people know about their entitlements, whereas they previously wouldn't have known as well. And also iSelect, you know, one of the aggregators of insurance, similarly advertising the fact that TPD insurance, what it pays for, and just so people get an understanding of what's available. So I think, you know, taking into account that, you know, the GFC hit people's super funds at the same time advertising from solicitors and others sort of promoted the fact that TPD was available. People may be looking to, you know, if they did have an injury, what other income systems do I have available? You know, I haven't got my super to rely on because it's just been decimated by the share market. Maybe all of those confluences really played a role in the trends in TPD claiming. I'm happy to take comments and questions as we go, I should have said as well, because all very experienced professionals working in injury schemes and other systems. So if you have anything to add, I'm happy to hear as well.
With the distinction between TPD and salary continuance, the salary continuance, isn't that a more sort of recent thing within super funds than compared to TPD, which has sort of been there all along?
Look, I can't really say that I know that for sure. I mean, group policies tend to include both group salary continuance and TPD underwritten through group policies. So I don't know that. Okay, so this, what's happened in workers' compensation as a comparison over the same period of time? And this shows the total benefits over that period from the Safe Work Australia data. And the summary is that overall over the same period, growth in benefits has been a lot slower, about 5% on average per annum over that period. And you can see a bit more of a steep increase pre-2009, and then that's sort of starting to level off a bit. So, I mean, there's a number of factors at play here. I mean, one of them is the GFC. When that hit, what we found anecdotally is a reduction in claim frequency but an increased duration for those people who are on weekly compensation, just with, I suppose, difficulty getting people back in suitable duties. So we did see increasing durations through the GFC. What we have also got in there are some sub-trends within common law, which I'll pull apart on a further slide. And then, of course, we've got benefit reforms that are impacting this experience. And I will also look at some of the schemes, some of the benefit reforms that happened. But briefly, you know, New South Wales WorkCover brought in reforms in 2012, which removed journey claims from the scheme and tightened up with work capacity reviews to limit periods on weekly compensation and treatment benefits, and also tightened up eligibility for common law. So that's responsible for some of the flattening off of the trends. Queensland WorkCover similarly had quite strong growth in common law settlements up to about 2009, and various legislative reforms after that have stabilised some of those trends as well. So that's the big picture. And I guess now it's interesting to try and see, well, obviously stronger growth within TPD and super, more flattening growth in workers' comp, some element of that being due to scheme changes. So let's now have a look at the underlying common law before we go and do a case study on one of the schemes that's had benefit reform. So as I said, underlying the overall trends, there's also common law experience which has got a bit of heat in it. So I've got just three schemes here that sort of pull that apart within workers' compensation as well. So from Finity's scheme report in the top left, you see the ACT workers' comp where the yellow sections represent common law damage payments, and that they've got an increasing trend. WA workers, the big red lines are redemptions. That's a lump sum style payment, like a commutation of benefits, if you like. That's been trending upwards. There is a little bit of heat in the orange bars, which are common law as well, with the third from the right. That's the largest ever common law settlement that they've had, and the single client was in that data point. That's from the PwC monitoring on their website. And WorkSafe Victoria similarly has had increasing common law lodgements for some time as an upward trend. So despite the sort of relatively stable-looking workers' comp experience, there is heat within common law in a number of these markets. And so there's evidence that more people are choosing common law avenues over time, which is consistent with the trend that we see in superannuation with TPD. So now let's have a look, a little bit more of a look. I mean, obviously there's solicitor involvement in all of that, and there's other benefit behaviours involved in all of that. Let's look now at a scheme design changes as well, because this is the trends in schemes that haven't had scheme design changes, but of course, and there's a whole bunch of schemes that have had scheme design changes. So let's have a look at those and categorise some of those before we try and draw the themes together. So broadly, I note three themes in terms of scheme changes that have happened over the last, say, 5 years. We've got a theme of increasing numbers of schemes with common law thresholds, so limiting eligibility for common law. We've got limiting the period for weekly benefits through use of work capacity tests in a number of schemes, and increasing focus on early intervention and rehabilitation. They're the three themes that I see in all the scheme design changes which have come about, and just giving some examples for those. So with common law, New South Wales work cover tightened the impairment assessment process so that people couldn't come back and have multiple impairment assessments to get over the 15% threshold. South Australia reformed both the workers and motor schemes, bringing in thresholds for various benefits. So then WorkCover Queensland as well brought in a linkage to the injury scale value for general damages back in 2011, and then also brought in a threshold for access to common law in total in 2013, which has actually now been unwound. But, you know, just generally those schemes, if they're bringing in restrictions to common law access, what we'd expect is that perhaps more people access super benefits through the TPD. But as I said, I haven't really been able to see that in the data specifically. It just seems to be that trend is across the board around the country. The second trend, giving limitation periods for weekly benefits. The work capacity review is now part of a lot of schemes, and there's thresholds for certain impairment levels to continue on weekly compensation in a number of schemes. So there's periods of 2 to 5 years now, typically in a lot of schemes for income benefits. So what would we expect off the back of that? Unfortunately, what we do know is that when work capacity reviews or other tests take place and weekly compensation ceases, that can be a point at which people do decide to go see a solicitor because they dispute the assessment or process or the fact that their benefits have been terminated. And that can actually, unfortunately, lead to an increase in common law processes. So, and what we might expect also to see in states where this has happened is that more people end up on the disability support pension if they have no other access to income systems elsewhere. So we do look at that later in the paper to see if there's any evidence of that on the disability support pension utilisation. That was a question that came up this morning as well. We're looking at the New Zealand scheme to see what sort of cost shifting happens. And finally, the third trend, increasing focus on early intervention rehabilitation. I mean, the classic example of that is South Australia Return to Work Scheme and their use of the mobile case manager approach. In theory, that should, if anything, reduce the welfare dependence. If you get more people back to work, it should also help, hopefully, avoid them going to see a solicitor and avoid them going down the other income avenues. It's a wait and see. Is that the outcome that we're going to have as a result of the changes to early intervention and rehab?
Lisa, is that a part of my next slide? Is that a part of though why super might be different? Because they don't have a lot of legislative requirements around return to work and rehabilitation potentially?
Yeah, well, you're right. Poor superannuation trustees don't tend to find out about these claims until a long way down the track, so their ability to influence and have any impact on, they don't really have a mechanism to have any early intervention at all. I agree. So it's a question of is it causative or is it the lack of early intervention caused the later, increase in claims, or are people seeking that because they're not getting what they need out of injury schemes? I don't know. It's a lot of questions, unfortunately, not a lot of answers in this work, which can be somewhat dissatisfying. But let's have a look. I thought I'd look at pull apart one scheme which has undergone some change to see what can we pull apart from this. And one which has got a significant number of years of experience after the change was New South Wales CTP, which had reform in 1999. And they brought in their a threshold for access to general damages. And then they also brought in reduced legals for the minor injury claims. They're the two biggest changes, but there's a number of others. Now, this graph here shows the cost per policy, and it's split up into the different types of claims. The one that's the most interesting is the yellow down the bottom, which are the minor claims which are represented. And this is reproduced from Ernst & Young's scheme report. So what we see immediately after the reform is that the yellow bars drop down. So that was basically the market responding to understand, particularly the solicitor market, I'm guessing, that the lower level severity injuries, given they weren't the average damages available, dropped off significantly. They were no longer economic to pursue. So a plaintiff solicitor firm wouldn't really make any money out of those minor whiplash style injuries. But over time, you can see that those minor representative claims have ticked up and ticked up and ticked up. And that has continued. And you would have heard in this morning's discussion from Andrew Nichols how that's actually become a big problem, and they've got even cases of fraud now continuing to drive that trend back upwards. So that a lot of that was because solicitors were able to argue to increase the size of average damages for those claims, particularly through awards of future economic superimposed inflation and future economic loss, and also more people getting care benefits. You know, you have to prove that you need those care benefits for at least 6 hours a week. But it seems to be pretty much every claim now can argue that and get a successful damages award for future care. So household services, we're talking about gardening and that sort of stuff. So I guess, you know, scheme design, you change a scheme, you have an intended outcome, and then I guess this goes to show that some of the economics of plaintiff solicitor firms can actually result in different behaviours than what you would have expected. I mean, ultimately, what you would have expected by bringing a threshold for minor claims is that you get fewer minor claims. But over time, it's all been unwound. So there are other things that come into play there. Another factor is also looking at, you know, putting yourself in the injured person's shoes, looking at their sources of wealth, you know, and considering what does that do in terms of their choice of income system between, say, periodic benefits and lump sum benefits? And this is from the Institute of Actuaries paper For Richer, For Poorer, which was published recently. And what this looks at is sources of wealth at age 65 projected for couples who are 30-year-olds today versus couples that are 60-year-olds today. So, in other words, we're looking at Gen X versus baby boomers. I think they're 30-year-olds, or maybe that's even Gen Y, I'm not sure. Next Gen Y. And anyway, when compulsory superannuation was introduced in 1999, that was about the same time as Gen X was starting work. So Gen Xers, typically speaking, will have more in superannuation savings and therefore subsequently less in their own personal, their housing wealth compared to older generations at the same point in time in their career. And I guess that's important to consider when you're looking at you know, putting yourself in an injured person's shoes and trying to figure out what they might try to do. Should they go common law? Does that make sense for them personally? So, for example, clients approaching retirement might still have adult children at home. They might still have a mortgage they're trying to discharge, and they might also be trying to get their adult children into the housing market, particularly if those Gen Xers are the ones who have all the superannuation savings and nothing put aside in their own household. Housing assets. So, I mean, that might make them be more likely to pursue a lump sum source of income over a periodic payment to sort of discharge those debts and to help family members. So, sticking with the theme of generational trends, this is a graph from the McClure Report, which looks at the trends in welfare utilisation. So, trying to pull apart now, is there anything within the trends of welfare that helps shed light on this? These interactions. So what we see there is actually the proportion of working age people who are accessing different types of welfare. And back in 1997, there was a peak of almost 25% of the working age population who were receiving some sort of income support. And that fell to 16.6% in 2008, and then the GFC hit and it went back up to 17.6% in 2010, and it's now eased back down to 16.7%. I think the biggest, the interesting one there is that sort of red shaded section up the top, and that represents the disability support pension. And you can see the proportion of working age people who have accessed the disability support pension has actually increased over that whole period of time. And that, you know, so the question is, why is that so? Is that because injury schemes are actually contracting or reducing the number of years that you can get paid weekly compensation, so more people on you know, end up on disability support? Or what is driving that? I know one factor that is driving that is the change in eligibility age for the pension for women, and that's increased from age 60 to age 65, and that sort of got phased in from 1995 over to 2013. So, you know, later, the aging population, the fact that we're working later, we've got later access to our superannuation, means that, you know, that all else being equal, more people end up accessing supports like the disability support pension. And it is in those older ages from 55 to 65 where we really see that increased utilisation. And you'd expect that that would also be the case within workers' comp, that you might end up getting more people who are, you know, working later and therefore higher numbers of those people injured later and relying on weekly compensation benefits through workers. So overall, the trends within of welfare within the global financial crisis are similar to the trends we saw within the workers' comp system that, you know, had that ramping up over the GFC. But the welfare trend during the GFC, of course, was also impacted by unemployment benefits, which is the navy blue section. But it's still that strong utilisation of the DSP is also a feature of that. So another thing to take into account, I guess, is that the McClure report recommended benefit reform. Disability support pensioners already had entitlement reform there in terms of who's eligible for that. So in the future, you know, it'd be important again to look at the impact if DSP eligibility changes again. That should have some impact on people's options and choices in terms of where they are staying in injury schemes and other considerations. Breaking that picture down a little bit further, this looks at the welfare utilisation by age group and also by type of welfare. Up the top is a 65 and over group, and the yellow is the age pension, just to put that into some sort of context. Welfare recipients comprise a higher proportion of the population for women than men at all age groups. And the biggest difference is in the 65 plus, and that's really due to two things, obviously. Women live longer, so they've got a longevity effect, so a higher proportion of them are receiving the pension, and also they have lower average savings. So in that group, you know, that men have more savings compared to women, more assets. Conversely, there's a high utilisation of the disability support pension at all ages by men rather than women. So what does this mean in terms of the interactions with other systems? It means, in summary, between 20 to 30% of people of working age are receiving some sort of welfare payment, mm-hmm. with the highest proportion of those being in the 35 to 44-year bracket. So therefore, welfare payments generally, if you're talking about people in injury schemes, you know, welfare payments would be expected to play an important role in decision-making processes for people navigating income systems, because a lot of these welfare payments, like family tax benefit and whatever, are also received by people who are in injury schemes. So I did break this down also in my paper to look at trends by state, because what I was particularly interested in was to see, is there any difference in the disability support pension utilisation by state, for example? And does that sort of have any resemblance to the level of generosity of the weekly benefits, say, available in each of the injury schemes? And interestingly, I didn't find a clear relationship there. What I did find was more of a driver of the relationship of the DSP utilisation was actually the level of unemployment in that state. So if you rank states by current level of unemployment and compare the current utilisation of DSP, there's a pretty good matching there in terms of that. So. Finally, the last thing I'll look at is behavioural economics, which also plays a part in understanding how people choose to navigate income systems. I think it's interesting that from the perspective of working in an injury scheme, you often think that the clients you're dealing with can be categorised as citizen one in the box up the top left. We think of injured workers bringing all their time and their attention and their ability to their interactions with an injury scheme. We expect that they plan their lives carefully and they only take into account facts when making decisions. And we expect that they think through all the information provided to them and they apply a rational thought process when they do that. And we think that people are only interested in outcomes which impact them and that they operate in a selfish fashion. That's the sort of lens that I think that we bring to people who are working, who are our clients in injury schemes. But in reality, behavioural economics tells us that the opposite is really true and people really operate more like citizen number two. People have limited time, limited attention and limited ability. And I think that was referenced in the TAC research around, you know, cognitive ability to actually deal with the complexity of the system in front of them. And I think we often assume that cognitive ability is higher than it actually is. And when dealing with complex injury schemes and insurance products, people don't read the complex and voluminous legalistic documentation provided to them. They don't read through the letters that you send them explaining why their claim's eligible or not eligible. They don't read product disclosure statements. Their cognitive ability and what they actually do with the information provided is very different than what we expect. People are very much biased towards present outcomes as opposed to future outcomes, and they use heuristics or shortcuts or clues in their decision-making processes. They also take into account social considerations. As I said, you know, I've got adult children. I've got to think about providing a leg up for them to get into the housing market, more so than I could stay on workers' compensation benefits until retirement. You know, my lump sum today seems to be more preferable to me than potentially, you know, the lifetime benefits, which might actually be a worse off economic decision. And lastly, the way information is presented to people makes a significant difference in the way people process that information and make decisions. And there's some, so from income systems perspective, there's lots of different relevant behavioural lenses which impact those decision-making processes. As I said, people tend to prefer lump sum compensation rather than ongoing periodic payments. There's a perceived inconvenience of having to engage with an injury scheme over a long period of time. And the present bias, as I said, makes those lump sums seem more preferable than staying on a long-term ongoing payment. And people see their future selves as a completely different person than their today self. They tend to discount future me and focus on today me, you know, and today me's needs. And that's another reason why they might go for lump sum payments. Another thing the behavioural economics tells us is that there's the concept of punishment and going out of one's way to seek punishment for someone when you feel a perceived injustice. And I think that's very clear in what Peter Berndt was discussing this morning and the role of fault, which has also been borne out by some of the research that ISCA has done in terms of how people engage with systems when they feel they've been wronged. So these are sort of the behavioural aspects of injury schemes and income systems. So all of these, you know, we take this into account with people, household wealth, and you start to put that yourself into your client's shoes. You can see how they might choose to navigate systems. And I think in many cases rely on solicitors to help them to navigate systems due to their complexity. And I'll bring that complexity to life a bit with a case study, which I've put together, best of my abilities, understanding welfare and Centrelink's rules and so on. So this is a case study of someone who's injured and they are in a workers' compensation scheme and they're currently they were receiving $45,000 as their pre-injury earnings adjusted for replacement proportions and so on. And they get put through a work capacity review and they're actually facing having their weekly compensation ceased. So they're looking at potentially, you know, not being able to work and they're age 60. We'll say they've got another 6 years to go into retirement. So their first option might be to try and access the Centrelink benefits, disability support pension, and if they're able to get some other entitlements, they might be able to receive $22,000 a year. So that's option one. They go to Centrelink. And that the total over 6 years is $132,000 on that option. Option two, perhaps they go to a solicitor and the solicitor is able to find that within their super policy they had default TPD and that average level of TPD might be something like $65,000. They have to pay their solicitor something for that advice. I've assumed a pretty modest $10,000 fee here for that advice. And so that's great. They get their $65,000 in year one, and they also go onto the disability support pension because there is no preclusion period, as I understand it, for TPD, because TPD is not treated as an income. It's actually treated as a compensation for a capital loss. So you go straight onto the DSP and you get your $22,000 a year. So over that 6-year period, you get $187,000, which would be about $31,000, which gets you to the ASFA level for a comfortable standard of living, I think, from the previous slide. Something like, something comfortable. Yeah. Option three, they go see the solicitor and they say that you can get an entitlement for economic loss. We can argue that for you. So the present value of that $45,000 at a 6% discount rate, which is an example from one of the schemes I work with, that would be a total of $221,000. And this time I've been a little bit more, I mean, maybe potentially realistic, very harsh. I don't know, you seem to pay $50,000 of that away to your solicitor. So you get a payment of $171,000 in the first year. But that also comes with a Centrelink exclusionary period. So you can't access any DSP for 2.3 years. And so, you know, over the remaining 6 years, that you get a total of $253,000. That's about $42,000 a year. It's less than the 45 that they were previously on, but certainly you can see they're not done too bad. Option number four, they're actually able to also argue for some pain and suffering. And what Centrelink does is it takes the total amount of damages you receive, multiplies it by 50%, assumes that that's the economic loss component, and calculates your preclusionary period, as I understand it. So there you get your pay your solicitor $50,000, you get $271,000, and then eventually you can go on the disability support pension and you get $55,000 a year on that scenario. And if you really hit the jackpot and you go through common law and get your TPD, which I understand you can, I don't think there's any problem with doing both. So under that scenario you get $64,000. But you can see all the different avenues open to you and the complexity of that and the different decision-making processes that you'd have to go through. So that's all I had. I'm happy to take any comments and questions and insights.
Thanks, Lisa. I might just start with a question if I could. So I guess one of my takeaways from what you've said is you've sort of got at least these kind of three different sort of systems. You've got the workers' comp system, you've got, you know, superannuation, and you've got the other government income streams who, you know, to a fair degree sort of operate independently of each other, you know, completely independently of each other. So I don't know if this is covered in your paper, but I mean, I suppose if, you know, sitting here thinking about workers' comp schemes, I mean, what, you know, in a magic world where you actually could, you might be able to take into account some of these interactions. What if anything, would a workers' comp or a CTP scheme do differently to sort of recognise these different sort of streams and, you know, that I suppose ultimately would get, would be fairer to its claimants. I mean, whatever fairer means.
I think it's good. I think first of all, even really getting a good picture for the interactions. Like, we don't even really know where our injured workers and injured roadies end up, do we? Mm. I mean, we can only hypothesise that a lot of them end up on DSP, but we don't know. And so, I guess the next thing would be once you do know that, then figure out, well, what's the lifetime cost of them staying on DSP versus what could we do for them if they stayed in the scheme? Mm. Is it a better outcome? And then if it were, then, you know, make changes accordingly. But I think we're operating in a bit of a vacuum is what I feel. We don't really understand all of these relationships as well as we could.
Just a follow on, I suppose, related. So have you uncovered any even sort of anecdotal evidence, you know, of schemes who do at least have some awareness of like their claimants who are sort of either accessing TPD or other government benefits? Or is it sort of...
Yeah. Look, I mean, I guess the stories I do hear are often the really sad ones where people have gone through a process of taking a common law settlement and have mismanaged that and then have ended up in a situation where they've got a big preclusionary period with Centrelink and they're actually a bit hard up against it because they didn't realise that common law lump sum was supposed to actually look after them for the rest of their lives. And so you hear about those stories, but, specifically about how that person then interacts with government. Beyond that, no, I don't really.
So, do you have any other questions?
Just a comment. My father's just celebrated the fact that he got a, I think, a $5 a fortnight pension, but as a result of that, he got the healthcare card.
Yes.
So it appears that the healthcare card is becoming more and more important in people's decision-making process. And have you seen people falling to one way so that they can get the healthcare card?
Yeah, and particularly the McClure Report talks about that. They say that it's very, it's perceived as be very valuable, and it's actually an inhibitor for, to try to get people back to work who are on the disability support pension in particular. I know within a welfare context that is very much the case. I don't know how that interacts with the injury schemes, but I guess, you know, when you're considering the preclusionary period, the other thing that might be weighing on your mind is that I have to wait out that time until I can also get access to a healthcare card. That might be something, but I guess it's only if a solicitor is actually giving a client that sort of advice and saying, you know, that, you know, as a result of this, you have to wait 3 years till you get Centrelink, and then, you know, you're going to have to fund all your medicals as well in the meantime. But then after that, you get some discounted medicals through the healthcare. Yeah, I don't know the extent to which the advice is that sophisticated.
So, for my husband's work as an injury financial advisor, I know that $31,000 would certainly not be sufficient for someone who needs care or any sort of attendant care. So, they would be very much considering some of the other options, and in considering some of the other options, they would be very much thinking about, well, if they don't get fully the attendant care that they need from the external providers, you know, what are their family situations? And so people who are actually making the decisions about whether they actually pursue some of the other systems would be dependent on, you know, the parents, you know, and their ability to provide, you know, their care. And so generally there's limited capacity, and they, like you say, you know, might not have their house fully repaid. So a lot of decisions are actually made by the parents or, you know, people who are, you know, acting on that injured person's behalf and their financial situation. But, yeah, $31,000.
I did misread it. So yeah, the Aspen Modest is 24 or 25, and the Aspen Comfortable is 23. That's what the Australian Superannuation Fund Association has estimated. Yeah, so it's not really. Sorry, it's not comfortable. It's sort of halfway between. It's not much over it, especially in VA care. I mean, care costs. I mean, thank goodness we've got the NDIS coming on board.
Lisa, if we actually knew where a lot of our injured workers or injured claimants ended up and we had this data, what would you do with it? Because Alex Colley's not in the room, but we've just kicked off a piece of work that's going to explore exactly that, but we won't know in probably 18 months. Mm. So if we want all 18 months, okay, well, here's these 300, 400, 500 workers in a group that are going to file all the way through from the data get the claim for possibly 4 or 5 years. And we have all this new information, and we have this. Question is, from a scheme perspective, then what do you do with it? You know, is there any practical application of this knowledge and this data once we get that? And is it just something we admire, or do you think there's actually something we can do with it?
Well, when you look at what's been done in New Zealand and now also in the Australian government, they're really looking at lifetime models for these schemes, situations. So welfare in New Zealand has already been modelled on a lifetime basis. So if you know that a particular cohort's are costing you a lot of money, and if they go in one system and they go into a different system, but if you look over their lifetime costs, they cost you a lot of money. And you can see that actually if they were just in one system where you applied interventions here and here and here, we could reduce their lifetime costs. I think that's what you do, right? If you have, but at the moment we know we've got information up to here, and then we don't know what happens to that person. And then they'll show up in welfare and someone else will be looking at their welfare costs. But, you know, we don't link it all together and have a full lifetime picture.
So even if the government agencies, like say the workers' comp schemes and the other government agencies could link together, the super schemes introduces a whole other layer, because not the vast majority of them aren't government organisations. So that would be challenging. Probably time for one more if we could.
I'll make the general comment. It's very useful for you to share information across jurisdictions. I mean, talking about predictability, and you know, someone in Victoria who moves to Queensland may have had compensation in Victoria. We wouldn't know that.
Mm.
We don't even know that.
Dreams of Federation. Hey, all right.
Well, if everyone could just join me in thanking Lisa for a really insightful presentation.